Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. I'm very pleased today to welcome Medha Patkar to the podcast. Medha is an Indian social activist working on various crucial political and economic issues raised by tribals, Dalits, farmers, labourers and women facing injustice in India. She's the founder member of Narmada Bachoa Andolan, a people's movement organised to stop the construction of a series of dams planned for India's largest westward flowing river, the Narmada. She's also one of the founders of the National Alliance of People's Movements, an alliance of hundreds of progressive people's organisations in India. Well, thank you very much, Medha, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Welcome.
Now, you have been a social activist for many years. Can you, just for the audience today on the podcast, give us a little bit of background about what you have been doing and what kind of issues concern you?
First and the foremost, I have been working in the valley of Narmada River in the western India, which is 1300 kilometers long river. And the overall river valley management has been highly destructive and displacement oriented. So the movement that has been going on till date over the last 35 years has also driven World Bank out of this valley. And that caused an independent international review through a Bradford Moore's mission that made the World Bank withdraw from the project. But the World Bank had to appoint an inspection panel, which is now taking care of the complaints by many project affected people or those who are for saving the environment of river valleys and even otherwise. This is the Save Narmada movement that is taking the governments by horns because there has been injustice and also non-sustainable way to push the project. So there was a long-term legal action and with many court cases and also the strong mass movements with mass actions, but all non-violent, peaceful in a way. And along with Narmada, I've been involved in the various other movements. May it be the movement of the urban poor, which is mainly based in Mumbai, in the state of Maharashtra, the slum dwellers in this financial capital of India, who face extreme kind of destitution, not just deprivation, and have to fight for every right, but especially their housing rights. And I'm also involved in many movements that challenge the corporates, that challenge the development projects which lead to enormous destruction or that bring in disparity as well. We have also been in the policy making and challenging the wrong policies and wrong acts. Beyond environmental issues, these are socio-political issues and also economic issues, because all those are interlinked as we see these. And hence the present challenge with the so-called Citizenship Amendment Act and the related two registers of citizens, which would exclude and also reject the citizenship of a large number of people, as it has happened in one of the states of Assam, which is a northeastern state in India, but which also is against the constitutional rights and is against the constitutional value framework, because religion is considered as one that would define citizenship. This is absolutely unacceptable, and not just the minorities belonging to the Muslim population, but various other organizations. We are together as under the banner, We the People of India, hundreds of organizations, and we are carrying on large protests everywhere. Just yesterday night, this time, I was in Bhopal addressing a large crowd along with others. So these are the various issues. And while fighting these battles, we know that we are yet to win the war, because it's not just the national issues, but also the international paradigm of development and the financial institutions' interventions, which matter a lot.
Yes, yes. That's very interesting, and I would like to talk about various issues and organizations that you work with and are inspiring and doing just important work with. Maybe just also, I like at the beginning to just get a sense, I guess, also from an Indian perspective particularly, but what is on your mind most? There's no shortage of worrying environmental crisis facing us. And I'm just wondering, are there one or two particular issues that are on your mind? You've touched on a couple of issues already, but maybe there are other things you want to say.
Narmada is one of the very, very crucial issue even today, because this river valley has a plan with 30 large and 135 medium dams. Now, big dams are really symbolic of the development paradigm that is followed, especially in the sectors like water and power. In order to generate power, storing water up to a very high head, what is done to the river and its environs is now known to even the United States of America. The nation state that has destroyed and demolished more than 1,000 structures on its own rivers. But we here in India have been following the paradigm that was set by the Tennessee River Valley Project in the same country. And we have built more than 5 to 6,000 large dams in this country. But we have not been able to solve either the water crisis with drought or even the flood calamities. And the rivers are being dried for a few months in a year and then flooded, destroying the forest, the best of agricultural and horticultural land, and displace in the Indian scale lakhs, that is hundreds of thousands of people. The Sardar Sarovar Dam that we have been fighting against, but mainly fighting against displacement without even rehabilitation and environmental losses without even compensation, has really brought out the reality which is not depicted in a number of reports, reviews, and commission's conclusions and recommendations. This project was pushed ahead with the World Bank's money, which was not even more than 5% of its cost then. But they were pushing the dam, and the Supreme Court of India had to stop the project with mass actions of ours outside, which had made an impact in the whole of the country. By the population affected, including farmers, laborers, fish workers, potters, boatsmen, the artisans, shopkeepers, all of them. In this process, we got a number of judgments, we got number of policies, and the law that was of the tribunal's award was to be followed. So we have got rehabilitation with land as the source of livelihood for thousands of people, not less than 20,000 families, and plot to build houses for more than 35,000 families, but thousands remain to be rehabilitated. And without their rehabilitation, the dam was filled, the reservoir was filled with massive inundation that has destroyed communities of the indigenous people, of farmers, and all the categories I just mentioned.
Yes.
So the fight still goes on.
Yes, yes.
It has huge impacts. And all the river valleys in India now more or less are facing the same fate, whether it is the Brahmaputra River Valley, which is an interstate river on the border of China, Bhutan, India, Tibet, and so on. And also within India, the Ganges, which is an interstate river, Krishna, which is an interstate river, and so on. I also have at my hands the huge agitation by the urban poor in Mumbai, which is especially by those who are left in the inhuman and unlivable situation in the slums. 5,000 and more families are facing very critical pollution on the border of Mumbai. And now the government is finally, after 2 years long struggle, compelled to give them alternative houses, with the High Court of Mumbai passing orders. The new government of Maharashtra has decided to support us, and they would distribute or allot the houses in the first week of February itself. So we have been fighting also against the new Citizenship Amendment Act, but we also are fighting to save the acts. The environmental laws are amended against the nature and against people. Labor laws are being amended and also abolished. 144 acts are to be withdrawn in the upcoming 2 months. And that will destroy the legal regime for the labor rights. I'm also an office bearer, president of a labor union, and we are fighting the battle by the mill workers of the Birlas, the known corporate family. They offered the two mills to us when we rejected VRS, and their sale or transfer of business was proven to be fraudulent. But now they are taking a step backward, and we are insisting that if they cannot run the mills, we will run the two mills, which are textile mills with 1,000 workers and more staff members. So these are the various battles. Basically, the communities that are leaning on the natural resources and human resources, those communities we have been working with. And through the mass actions, we think that the transformation that could be brought in, not just in the legal framework or laws, but in the societal, values, and also the changing the relationship between the state and its people, that would go a long way in bringing true democracy and also a paradigm of development that would be sustainable and just.
The very important work and such wide-ranging work you're doing. Now, the Narmada Bachoa Andolan is NBA.
Yes.
That's
yes.
How long has that social movement that's been going for certainly 20, 30 years? I'm just wondering, what other movements were there when you started that, when that started, and what the lessons were, and maybe just some insights into what you've learned about these massive social movements and what can be achieved.
It started in 1985, so we have completed almost 35 years. In August, we will be completing. This movement started with the raising of the voice of the displaced, but we raised various questions, the cost-benefit analysis, the distributive injustice, and the wrong transfer of resources against the constitutional framework of equitable economic development and against the sustainability too, right since the beginning. Now, that was a time when displacement was an issue for the indigenous communities and the development projects were being pushed ahead, especially with the international financial institutions' involvement, but also with the industrialization, corporatization, highest level of mechanization being considered as the most modern economic development paradigm. And that was leading to the destruction of the natural resources, which would ensure food security and water security for millions of people in the country. So when we challenged this, we challenged the bad planning of the projects or no planning, non-participatory approach, where the people are never consulted or taken into consideration with their own dreams of life and dreams of progress for themselves, and not even following the laws of the land. Like, for example, in the indigenous communities, there is a special law called as the Adivasi Swashasan Law. That is the law for self-governance in the scheduled tribe communities, as they are called in India. And with all this, we realized that not just the communities and their livelihoods, but also the river itself was getting destroyed. When the capital is lost, what would we pass on to the next generations is a question that we have raised. And we exposed the false affidavits, false reports, false claims, whether about the social rehabilitation or the environmental compensatory and mitigatory measures. We took the battle to the United Nations, the ILO and the Commission for Human Rights. We took the battle to the US Congress with the United States of America being the foremost investor in the World Bank, and to the World Bank missions. And internationally, there was a huge cry halt by the various organizations which questioned the World Bank as to where their mark or their yen or their dollar or their euro was going. And then finally, the board of directors had to decide to review the project first, and then based on the report and then some follow-up, withdraw from the project. So that was a victory. Now, this leads to questioning in the case of many projects of what happens when the international financial institutions come in. They, first of all, do not follow, not even understand many a times, the laws of the land. And that is absolutely against the sovereignty of the nation state, not just the sovereignty of the state, but the sovereignty of its people that deal at the units of communities. And the people cannot take out rallies to Washington, D.C. Or to Geneva either. And hence, the battles are to be fought at the ground level. Now, the indigenous communities had fought their own battles even during the freedom movement against the British rule, and even in the independent India, because although we have got the political independence, the real freedom for the communities have not yet come true. The battles were also on in the by the laborers, toiling masses in various fields. The farmer struggles raise the issue of why are the farmers compelled to commit suicides. There have been more than 350,000 farmers having committed suicide within a decade. Mind you, even in 2017-18, more than 10,000 farmers committed suicide in India. That's because of indebtedness, which is because of the inappropriately low prices for the farm produce. And that is true about all natural products and also the human labor. The valuation or estimation of the value of human and labor and natural resource investment is underestimation. So all these movements were having an impact on the Narmada movement. They were our supporters on one hand, and we were also joining hands with them. And when the Narmada became a very well-known movement, all the people across the country and even internationally have tried to engage us in their battles. And we have been happy to do that. And it's vice versa.
Indeed, indeed. And so you're increasingly, so what the lessons and the inspiration from the Narmada movement, to what extent is that impacting other movements in India dealing with the problems of dams?
Dams, especially the large dams, which we analyzed and studied across the country, because I was also one of the members, commissioners on the World Commission on Dams, and the other commissioners, 12 of us altogether. The other 11 commissioners came from the World Bank, its advisor, there were representatives of the big corporates like ABB and Siemens, and who were building large dams. There were also a CEO of the Murray River Valley in Australia, a high-level official from the Three Gorges Dam in China, and we too, one of the members of the India's Planning Commission, was also the Consulate General for South Africa from India. He was a great economist. And myself on behalf of the movements and some NGO representatives from Philippines and America, we all together studied the large dams, and the report of the World Commission on Dams brought out the fact that the environmental and social impacts of large dams are not never really fully compensated, and there are better options. Now, this options assessment, we know, has not been taking place while planning a project in any sector. And unless the options are assessed, and not just assessed, but the right option is selected based on sustainability and justice, the impact such as climate change or the inhuman internally displaced communities, that is not going to stop. There may be conferences, conventions, and summits held across the world, but those kinds of, treaties and all that decisions made do not on its own stop the projects and the plans which are depleting the resource base and changing the climate. And we have learned that it is not just the environmental issues, but it's the socio-politico-economic issues that really affect the environment. And environment includes human beings, not just the ozone layer. It includes the forest, not just the wildlife, and the rivers. So when these resources are being destroyed, what is left for the future generation to build upon or to invest as natural resource capital? These are the questions. And we have learned from the long experience of dealing with the state in India that the laws and rules and regulations are invariably violated. And even the Supreme Court judgments are not complied with. So the battle has to be very, very perseverant. And the women's and youth's participation, and also the participation of the homogeneous indigenous communities, really go a long way. They have that kind of perseverance. They have a very creative approach to strategies. And we have also learned that it's only non-violence that works. Yesterday was the death anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi. The Satyagraha, which is the pledge for truth, is to be operationalized and strategized in various forms. So we have had a number of hunger strikes, fasts in the Narmada movement. And that really has shaken ourselves, our own fighting brethren, the community people, and also have shaken the state, and also have really appealed to the larger society. So this is what a mass movement really achieves. So the various movements in the country today look back to the history of the Narmada struggle, which they call as a saga of Narmada. And all the strategies, like from studying the various documents, the room I'm sitting in is full of documents, if you happen to have a look, because a number of reports, number of people's tribunals, all kinds of popular mechanisms we had to resort to in order to challenge the flawed or even fraudulent reports, claims to affidavits by the state governments and the Union of India. And that included the legal battles, as I said. I had to stand up in the court since 2007 and fight the legal cases ourselves, whether the case of corruption, which continued for 8 full years, the case on rehabilitation, that is displacement without rehabilitation, so on and so forth. But we also, as I said, had to stand before the World Bank and challenge their presidents, who had to, one of them, Wolfenson, had to stay on the road in front of 3,000 people who had reached Delhi from the Narmada Valley and answer our questions for hours together. So these are the various experiences which have taught us all these lessons. And the international intervention is really an interference into our exercises of lawmaking, policymaking, and also in the implementation of the laws of the land. It's fortunate that recently there is a judgment by the United States Supreme Court in the case of Tata Mundra Thermal Power Project in the state of Gujarat in India, that even in the case of projects which are funded by the World Bank, the laws of the land will have to be followed, which they were not accepting earlier. So I suppose that would be applicable to all the bilateral and multilateral international financial institutions. When we drove them out of the Narmada Valley, we had to challenge each one of them, ODA of UK, OECF, then of Japan, then the SWEDA of Sweden, CEDA of Canada, USAID of United States of America, so on and so forth. And this we had to do because they were already in Narmada Valley and they had very ambitious plans to really fund, because they are, after all, bankers, not charity donors.
So that the impact, what has been the impact on the prevalence of international investors getting involved in these kind of projects now? Has this resulted in organizations and finance leaving, or is it still going on? To what extent is this a big driving factor, do you think, certainly in the large dams and energy construction?
They're still going on with the large dams. As I said, we have not yet won the war. But the battles are won, no doubt. The inspection panel, which came into existence as a result of the experience with the Narmada project and the Narmada struggle, as the panel itself has stated in its 25 years report, which may be available on the internet. The panel really heard a number of cases from various countries across the world. And as far as stopping the projects, they stopped immediately after Narmada, the Arun Dam in Nepal. But the Nepal's present government is again trying to revive the dam, and the people are, you know, taking up the struggles. There are other dams like Pancheshwar in the Nepal state, which is an intrastate project, but that is also questioned. The inspection panel recently gave its report against the Tata Mundra project, as I said, where 10,000 fish workers are affected, but they were not considered as a part and parcel of the displaced communities. So that was challenged before the panel, and panel really gave out good reports from our point of view, bringing out all the flaws in planning and also violations of the World Bank's its own manual. The World Bank finances the corporates and pushes the projects, such as that project. Recently, the World Bank have also withdrawn from the Amravati City project. That is a huge capital city establishment in the state of Andhra Pradesh, which is one of the southern states in India, which is to destroy the rivers, destroy the best of agricultural land, also the sand illegally mined, so on and so forth. And that was not necessary because they could have established capital on barren land, at least much part of it, and could have had this decentralized establishment of various parts of the capital, new capital city. That is the result of the legal battle fight before the National Green Tribunal in India also.
Yes.
But the World Bank's withdrawal has now created a scenario that it is halfway through that the farmers, laborers, Dalits, the scheduled caste people, all of them are needing our inputs to decide as to what to do when it is halfway through. So I'm going to attend a meeting very recently. Now, number of dams are questioned within India, whether there is international financial investment or not. And that is considered now as a bad paradigm, because when the state of Maharashtra, for example, with Mumbai as its capital, faced drought just 2 years ago in 17 of its districts, which is a smaller administrative unit than the state. It was a formidable situation, most formidable. But the big dams, half of the big dams in India are built in that state, but that could not solve the problem. So finally, the state of Maharashtra has now diverted its whole attention to decentralized water management. And as far as we are concerned, we think it is always land, water, and green cover, tree cover management. It cannot be looked at in an isolated manner. On the other hand, the large dams which submerge huge amount of biomass, as it has happened in Narmada. At least 2,000 big trees in each village community got submerged, and more than 100 communities, up to 178, got affected, submerging these hundreds of thousands of trees last monsoon. And there was a harsh hue and cry, and again, we had to rush to the Supreme Court, we had to take to the fast, and then the government came for dialogue and so on and so forth. But no one could save these trees because they had given false claims of having clear felled the trees and compensated it through afforestation. Now, these are the claims which are always proved to be fake claims. And that's why the climate change is contributed to by huge magnitude of biomass decay that happens in the case of big dams. This is an international expert's statistical calculation as well. So all these projects which are following the wrong kind of technology and not going in for options assessment, as I said, and choice of the right kind of sustainable technology are really creating a scenario which has led to the clock ticking, showing us the huge destruction of Earth ahead. So I think it's not just large dams, but the mines. The mining is also challenged, not just the coal mining, but all kinds of mining, where also they are not considering the sustainable and reasonable optimum scale and also the right kind of technology. They're going in for open cast mining, so on and so forth. And that is at the cost of the agricultural land and the indigenous communities and so on. The pollution is also another impact, as I said. So all these impacts altogether, social and environmental especially, also lead to an economy which is full of disparity. They are taking away, snatching away the resources as livelihoods from the communities who live very honestly without any corruption, without destruction of others, and without exploitation of others, and without destruction of natural ecosystems. They are the ones who are losing, and the others benefiting include the corporates, the contractors, the builders, the financiers, and those who, you know, come out to be the first beneficiaries. Even space in the new benefits and the regime that is newly brought in is not granted to those who are compelled to sacrifice. So all these issues really are interlinked.
No, it's very interesting you say that. I'm interested, more generally, India has continued to, and the government has continued to give clearance to new mining projects, coal mining projects, and there are, you know, major issues in terms of access to power and energy across India. I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about that? Because it is very worrying, these coal mining projects, these coal projects.
The power generation in India actually can really go through a period of moratorium. We have already achieved more than 200,000 megawatt power generation capacity. But what we have failed to achieve is the distributive justice. The rural India still lacks even 1 point power supply. And the farming India also face hell of difficulties because of the high rates of power or submergence of the power grids, the whole network, as it has happened in Narmada today. The farmers are facing hell with all the transformers going under waters and reconnections not taking place, so on and so forth. But the power generation can come through the huge solar power that we are gifted with, the all renewable sources of power, rather, wind power, the tidal wave power, and the human power. We have 130 crores population, but we are facing unemployment because we are not employing human power, the human resources effectively, and with the primacy given to that as employment generating paradigm. And that's what is really the wrong kind of direction that is leading to the impact on the coal stores and also through hydropower, which is not clean, neither cheap nor clean, which is also destroying the riverine ecosystems. So we have to go in for renewable sources of power generation. But we are not really considering that as the best option in the energy framework. And that's because the large projects benefit the large contractors and investors. and they push the projects without proper impact assessments. There are laws which are also going to be weakened, are being weakened. The participatory mechanisms such as public hearing in an area which is going to be directly affected, and the hearing where the people would be able to put forth their objections, their alternatives, so on and so forth, that is going to be, that is not taking place anymore, except one category of projects which are considered as highly impactful projects. So the whole decision-making process itself is not just undemocratic, but all unscientific. Even the science, with all its limitations, can give us huge amount of data that can lead to analysis that will in turn lead to the right kind of choice of technology and right kind of processes to really plan the projects and implement the projects. Even the post-facto evaluation does not take place in most of the projects, whether those are water projects or power projects. And hence, the same old paradigm is being followed in spite of so much of UN cry about climate change and so much of impact already faced here. The evaporation of water to, impact on the Himalayan river catchments, onto the groundwater, onto the standing crop, which gets burnt, the drought and flood cycles, all these impacts are faced, but not really paid serious attention to in India till date. Now the youths have come forward, attracted by someone like Greta, and also now learning on their own about the environmental issues and ecological science. They are taking the lead, but they are also in so many sectors. They have to fight the wrong educational policy. They have to fight the suppression and repression against the students' organizations, which is going on, so on and so forth. So to the extent possible, the voice is raised, but it's more internationally than nationally, I must say. But all the organizations, mass movements, have been realizing that this is an issue that they cannot ignore. And they cannot be just issue-based social movements. They have to have a comprehensive outlook towards the paradigm that is followed in all the sectors.
Well, it's very interesting you talk about that, and you talk about the impact of Greta in India as well. I wanted to just maybe finally talk about your work at the National Alliance of People's Movements, which has been going for several decades. And I'm just wondering, we've seen the rise and success relatively of the Sunrise Movement in America, of the Extinction Rebellion. And I'm just wondering, what are some of the lessons from your work at the National Alliance of People's Movements? You talk about need to move beyond issue-based approaches. You mentioned the increasing importance of youth, but notwithstanding yes. the issues they have. How effective would you say the National Alliance of People's Movements is today? And what are, would you say, one or two of the lessons about building this broader social change alliance?
This National Alliance of People's Movements came after there was a huge kind of mass gathering in the Valley of Narmada in 1989. There onwards, we decided, because 350 organizations had participated in that massive gathering, and a number of veterans in the field of environment, in the social transformation, who were in the people's politics, not in the electoral politics, had come together in a place called Harsud, the township which is no more, gone under waters, 700 years old township. But beyond that destruction, we decided to form an alliance, because along with this challenge of the development paradigm, there were two other challenges that really formed the tripolar framework of ideology that is accepted and followed by the National Alliance of People's Movements. I will call it NAPM. NAPM. The two other challenges were one of communalism. The secular India has a framework of governance and also democratic participation by the people beyond caste, creed, gender, and religious discrimination. But there was a beginning of attacking the minorities in India, especially the Muslim population, but not just them. And the one of the major issue was of the temple versus mosque issue. And recently, the Supreme Court has given its judgment after years. But it was in those days, in 1990s, early 90s, that the massive illegal action of demolishing the mosque had taken place. So we decided to challenge the casteism on one hand and this communalism on the religious basis on the other. Caste also is a great barrier to unity of our country, and enormous injustice is faced by the so-called lower caste people. And hence we are for caste annihilation, not just empowerment of the so-called lower caste face exploitation and discrimination. But we have to work with the Dalits, the so-called lower castes, who are really the real contributors in production and distribution and so on. So this was one of the poles in our tripolar ideology, other than the alternative development paradigm. And the third challenge was the economic challenge. The globalization, liberalization, privatization paradigm that is benefiting the multinationals, including the Indian multinationals, that had come into the Indian economy since late 1970s or early 1980s. And that had changed a number of policy frameworks in India that had really pushed the so-called development beyond limit in its acceleration, destroying the natural resources and also killing the democracy and democratic institutions in the country. From the legislatures to bureaucracy to the media to the judiciary. All these four pillars of democracy, as they are known in India, are affected by the globalization, which is a free flow of capital, which is also undesirable and unacceptable influence of the international forces. And pushing the consumerism through its own market as against the labor-intensive technologies, industrialization, and paradigms in various sectors. So we challenge that. We challenge corporatization as the neo-capitalism, because the monetary capital really takes place of the human resource and natural resource capital, and it buys over and kills the sources of livelihood and employment. Now, this year, for example, at present, for example, all these three pillars are proved to be the real basis for our own ideology. And this is now seen by all the movements. So we feel happy that the tripolar ideology that NAPM thought of is now taken seriously by various movements. Maybe they begin with, but they go in the course of time, linking the various issues and forming their own comprehensive framework. So the human rights organization, the labor rights organizations, the displaced people's organizations, the environmental organizations, women's organizations, Dalit organizations, the Adivasi, the indigenous people's organizations, there are all categories of organizations which are part of NAPM today. The problems or the barriers we faced, which we had to cross effectively, were of different kinds. One, in order to derive a common denominator, not minimum common, but maximum common denominator, we had to really have had long, in-depth dialogues. The Dalit organizations, for example, would not initially take the environmental issues seriously. But now when the urban slums are evicted and the grazing grounds, which are the sources of livelihood for many Dalits, or even the contract labor, all these sectors are affected with the kind of development mongering that is going on. They realize that these are the issues that are also their issues. Similarly, those who work on the environmental issues do not consider casteism or communalism or secularism as an alternative value to be that serious challenge. But today, they all are in that too. When the Muslims are targeted and all other communities who do not live on paper system are going to face the very serious impact of the Citizenship Amendment Act or the registers, which has happened in one of the states already. All organizations have come forward and fighting the battle. This kind of unity of the progressive thinking organizations is a must, because otherwise, if you take up one issue, not only that you cannot carry on till long, but you also do not get into the political education of your own communities, the people you work with. And then they cannot really think of the political, economic, and social alternatives, which only can give them a way out of the multiple crises that is faced by all of them. So the fish workers have to come together with farmers when they have to save any river valley or even the coastal area of India. That's what has happened in many of our movements. When the Enron corporate was fought against, the farmers and the fish workers were together. When we were in jail, all of them were fighting outside to get us released. And that was also a very effective battle. In the power sector, privatization was coming in a big way. So I can give a number of examples of that kind, but let me stop here.
Yes, so you're saying that dialogue is important, education is important. How long does it take for this to happen for people? I see many organizations who are working on really important issues, but are very narrowly focused on those issues, and they don't have they certainly don't feel they have the space, the resources, the time to deal with other issues. They already are struggling, yes, dealing with their issues. Yes. How does this happen, that you get a broader collective, that you connect together these issues?
No, you're right, you know, and they are also right in a way that we all get bogged down with the local issues, and that is not to be underestimated or not to be considered as unnecessary or not required. That is necessary. People have to, the activists have to be rooted at the mass roots. I don't call it grassroots, because grassroots are very superficial. And that perseverance and long-term battles are also a must. So only a few of an activist group can go out. Like if I go out, my colleagues here have to continue. If I fail to build that kind of leadership, then we fail to really carry on any movement towards success. And that gets affected in terms of the networking also. Because when you try and bring together various movements, we look at each other. And everyone look forward to some success in some moments, which give them a hope. And that moment, with its some success and broad experience, really makes an impact in terms of the other moments, sort of believing in the kind of optimism and feeling optimistic and in coming together. I also think that when the state becomes more and more oppressive, this happens much more, that the people have to stick to their own areas, localities, territories, or the sectors. And they cannot be said to be wrong in that, because after all, we have to survive in order to fight. And for survival, we have to face the state, the omnipotent state, with its own force, which is brutal many times, especially the moments when we are the moments that challenge the system. We are attacked more because they are scared of us. They are scared of those who are not scared of them. And then the physical force, not just the police, but even army, is brought in. Today, even the firing is taking place against Muslims, as it has happened in the state of Uttar Pradesh. I visited 5-6 states recently where this agitation is going on. And all the movements are giving lot of time to this agitation. But even in this agitation against the law, the Citizenship Amendment Act, there are voices which are raised as voices for freedom. Now, freedom from what? We all, in our speeches, in our dialogues, in our interaction with the agitators all over, are interpreting it as freedom from all kinds of discrimination, including gender injustice. Freedom from the non-sustainable paradigm of development. Freedom from destruction and deprivation that is caused by the wrong economies. Freedom from unemployment, freedom from corruption, freedom from, the globalization paradigm. So interpreting the whole movement, expanding its ideologies, make it inclusive of more and more movements. And these two are the two sides of the same coin. And I think that's why we have to all be inclusive. And we have to be open-minded. The whole delicate process of bringing movements together is experienced by all of us. And that experience is not just full of barriers and challenges. They're very, very, very positive experiences as well. When we all joined the movement against the POSCO company in Orissa, we were all targeted. The company had announced that anyone who would meet me will have to pay a fine of 10,000 rupees. So all those women who had cuddled me in the previous visit had closed their doors and were really watching me through a small gap in the doors. And that was as late as 9 o'clock at night. And then there was no place to sleep, so we had to go far away and sleep in another village communities and stay there. So these kinds of experiences are very interesting. But the community did not break from the movement, did not break the relationship, me as a personal or our NAPM, but rather took our support much more little later. So there are ups and downs, but also we have to fight from local to international. So without each other's support, we cannot really win those battles. When we were fighting on the Narmada issue, we had an international action group. Now, I was not going international all the time. None of us, my colleagues as well. But we had regular communication. And even once when I went to U.S. Congress and presented the case before the United U.S. Congress committee, it was a grand experience. The chairman really, appreciated the presentation. I had one lawyer from Gujarat and one economist from Maharashtra. But really, they gave so much time against their own rules and then directed the World Bank to appoint a review commission for Narmada. So these kinds of experiences where the local activist also has to go international, that I think makes a difference. Because the not just passionate presentation, but presentation full of the mass level, ground level reality is different from an advocate's a lawyer's presentation. And the political analysis gets intermingled, interconnected with the issues which may be just legal or social. So I think the networking really helps that. You cannot carry on all the activities yourself. Movement requires support from other organizations in documentation, in research, in representation, so on and so forth. So these are the complementarity and multi-stakeholders kind of coming in. And that really gives us scientific inputs, technological inputs, but also political and social inputs. And people get inspiration from each other. It's not just the so-called leaders of the movement. It is always a collective leadership that has to be there in order to carry on for a long time, as long as more than three decades as we have. It's always a collective leadership. People may not be knowing all the names of all our leaders, but they play different roles, and that space must be granted to them in order to be successful. We recently had, after 25 years of NAPM, biannual convention in the state of Orissa, attended by 800 delegates. And what a force there was in the slogans, in songs, in presentations, a special session by the youngsters, special session for the state alliances. We have this decentralized structure. Now, we have not succeeded 100%. We are weak in some states. We are strong in other states, so on and so forth. But as long as there is a group of activists, and we have changing group of conveners that we insist upon. I had taken up advisorship for 4 to 6 years in between. This time they pulled me in and pushed me in the conveners team again to make me again remain as active as I have been. To go across the country and so on. But I'm finding it very difficult to manage Narmada and the urban poor struggle and the mill worker struggles, which are my local struggles, but not that small scale struggles, large scale struggles, and also carry on the responsibility nationally. So I'm not personifying it, but this is my personal experience, which can be understood and applicable to many other activists which are also facing the same thing. But we need to fight at different fronts, multiple front strategy we have to evolve. And we also have to study a lot. Every movement requires an in-depth study of various documents and various laws and so on and so forth. And we have to keep ourselves updated. All these challenges are the challenges of any networking.
It's fascinating, the work and the depth and the number of projects and your inspiring voice and actions. Are you optimistic, Modi? You mentioned this citizenship law. There's increasingly centralized ID and data and so forth. Do you see those being used against social movements? How worried are you?
The social movements are the only ways to face this rightist government. The government which is absolutely against the people's freedom, against the constitutional value framework. The government which is changing the laws of the land in order to benefit the corporates more and more. disinvesting not less than 50 profit-making public sector enterprises, including the railways, which is the largest network of railways in the country and in the world, and so on and so forth. And they are really using the religious fundamentalism as the weapon for fighting against the other political parties and gain their own vote bank. So they are not even ready to accept voters as citizens and challenging everyone. They are not just wasting thousands of crores of rupees at the cost of the basic services and amenities to the poor people and all those who are made poor because they are not paid appropriately. But they are also destroying the, you know, the fabric of unity within diversity that we have been proud of here in India. Now, this is something which is to be taken by horns. And the students in the universities that are attacked, that attack is because they want to push in their own student organizations affiliated to this particular rightist party. And that they want to do by hook or crook. They're also going international and joining hands with Trump's or with the Bolsonaro, who was one of the guests for the Republic Day of India, which was really shocking, so on and so forth. And they are expanding their markets, and they don't mind joining hands with China, but they consider Maoists, those who believe in Maoism in India, not us, but many others, as the terrorists. So this is all contradictory approach in their whole governance. And the governance is towards fundamentalism and communalism, and that cannot be tolerated. When religion is made a criterion or a basis for citizenship, this is absolutely against the constitution of India. And people who are fighting have now taken constitution in their hands, not just the Indian flag, and it is the country that is at their hearts. So this is the great achievement. The Muslim women coming out, that shows how the movement shakes the community that is fighting from within. They don't just challenge the state, but they challenge themselves. This is what is happening to all of us. So I think these battles have to be built into a war. We have taken to many alliances. When it was the land acquisition related issues, we formed Bhumi Adhikar Andolan. Hundreds of organizations came together. That was also necessary in order to challenge the ordinances that was brought in three times. And they tried to change the 2013 Act, which we had to work hard with the previous government. That was at least a government which was for dialogue, the Congress government, the centrist government, with some leftist joining them. And hence, we had to form that platform to challenge the land-related issues. That still goes on. We have another alliance. I'm also a member of the working group there with about 300 farmers' organizations, which is All India Farmers Struggle Alliance. And that is challenging the indebtedness, no appropriate prices, and no freedom from debt. So we want these things to be achieved. We have put forth before the parliament two drafts of the two enactments. We want a special session on farmers' issues of the parliament. We also have the forest dwellers, you know, sort of alliance. We have the alliance of the activists working on right to information. We have part of a number of alliances, but more or less, and now active in each, because some have to take the lead in each alliance, and there has to be an alliance of alliances. Today, in fighting this Citizenship Amendment Act, the National Population Register, and National Register of Citizens, I said in my past few speeches, as yesterday night, that we are fighting NPR, National Population Register, by another NPR, which is National People's Resistance. And we are fighting National Register for Citizens by National Resistance Against Communalism, National Resistance Against Casteism, National Resistance Against Corporatism, National Resistance Against Corruption. So we have to really interpret this latest movement, and we have formed a banner called We the People of India, in which hundreds of organizations, even the IAS officers who have left their jobs and taken up this movement, like one Mr. Kannan Gopinathan or Kanaiya Kumar, a popular activist in the country today, so on and so forth, and the Tista Sakilwad, who fought on the Gujarat riots issues. All of them have joined together. We are all together, and we have one banner, We the People of India. The next meeting, 4th February, will have all of us together. I'm a part of the advisory committee with Rajiv Gandhi and others. And there is a working committee also. So together, I think we will work out an effective strategy. And the act is passed, but many, many political parties and state governments have, as a result of the people's movement, decided to oppose this new act and the registers. So that's also a victory, but we have not yet reached the horizon.
Well, I wish you the very best of success with all of the great work you're doing, Mehta. It's very inspiring to talk to you, and it's just such important work. And thank you so much for sharing with us today all your insights and experiences. And I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.